Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the podcast. It's A Noise from the Deep.
The Greenleaf Music Podcast.
And that's Michael Bates.
Yes, I am. And that's Dave Douglas.
Thanks for listening once again to episode 26.
Yeah, and we are recording this the night after, or the morning after, a pretty great font show.
Festival of New Trumpet Music has been in full swing all month, and it's been great.
Amazing band, the No BS Brass Band.
No BS Brass Band and Banda de los Muertos, right. Brooklyn's finest norteño Mexican brass group. It was fun. Times. Michael drove my car home for me, which was very nice of him and wise.
I think it was wise. And then we got up this morning and Kurt Konofke came over and we sat down and had a chat.
So we're here in Brooklyn, New York, USA, planet Earth. And we talked to Kirk and listened to his music. We're talking with Kirk Konofke about endorsements. Product endorsements. Kirk.
I purchased Swiss Chris from the Louis Armstrong house, and I use it on the road.
What is Swiss Chris?
That's Louis Armstrong's favorite laxative that he was addicted to.
And there's a lot of ads where he is shilling for Swiss Chris.
Okay, wait a minute.
Leave it all behind you,
and
the slogan.
He invented that, leave it all behind you. They didn't ask him to do it. He was so adamant about the product.
I have to say that I was not expecting this interview like this. But, you know, we've known each other a long time.
You know, you hang out with trumpet players, and that's what... And he, you know, Kirk, you play, you know, cornet, and people were bugging me during the trumpet festival when you played at Smoke. People were, during your set, coming up to me, you know, that's not a trumpet.
And you listen
yeah,
to
that. Yeah, I know. It's like every... time.
Really?
And Graham Haynes plays and people are like...
People really say that?
Yeah.
Well, there's not going to be a cornet festival, maybe. That could be an offshoot.
Well, if you guys want to do that, I would be first in line to...
Dave, you have a tune that you wrote about a cornet.
I played cornet. Do you remember that period?
I do.
It was some years ago now.
That was the first time you played
it. The cornet is a fickle friend.
Oh, man.
It's the name of my tune.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I 6 month whirlwind romance with the cornet and then I... And I gave it back, and I went back to the trumpet, because I found that I couldn't do some of the stuff that I needed to do on certain gigs that I was playing. Like, for me, and, you know, I want to ask you about your playing, and because, you know, I heard you doing a lot of that stuff with that instrument. It's a very special instrument, but for me, I found, like, 85%... I could do the stuff that I did on trumpet, and then there was that extra 15% that I couldn't get it to do. You know, I know that you got your instrument from Ron Miles.
Yeah.
And it's a Monet.
It is.
Instrument, so it's heavier than a normal trumpet, right? Thicker metal.
It's very heavy. It weighs almost 3 times.
How much more?
3 times.
So how much did the Martin Committee weigh?
It weighed a little over a pound, and then weighs 3 pounds, which doesn't maybe sound like a lot, but it is when you're holding it up all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a bass.
Do some stretches. If you had to hold a bass up to your face off the ground. No, it's not.
That's a concept.
So the instrument was one of the first cornets that Dave Monet made in this design. And there's really only a handful of them because there's not a lot of demand for it.
Okay, so were you playing a cornet before you started playing this cornet? Or was this just...
Well, I always played... Well, the long story is I got an old cornet, almost like the one that Graham Haynes plays, when I was a kid, and I loved it, and I played it on all my gigs and everything. But then I had to play trumpet in the orchestra. They wouldn't let me play my cornet in the orchestra. So then I just played trumpet mostly under the impression that I would always have to play trumpet in order to get work. And then when I moved to New York, I was playing trumpet, and I loved playing trumpet and made a lot of my favorite records on it. But then I always wanted to go back to cornet, but by that time, my old cornet just didn't really function well enough for me to switch back to that instrument, even though I loved it. So I was talking to Ron about it, And he said, I've got some cornets. You should come by the house and you could borrow one.
So this is in Denver.
This is, well, actually, this is after I was already living in New York. Mm-hmm. I was with Matt Wilson's band in Denver. And every time I go to Denver, I hook up with Ron again.
Nice.
Because he's an old buddy.
Yeah.
So went to his house and he had all these different cornets and I was playing them all. And he kept saying, well, you should try Dave's cornet. Dave Monette's cornet. And I kept saying, no, I don't want to try it. Because if I like it, I'm screwed. It's nothing that...
And these are...
Yeah, so I was thinking about...
They're rare and they're expensive.
Well, very expensive. And the guy is like a bespoke, you know, trumpet. Like Wynton Marsalis famously plays Monette.
Yeah, okay. Forever.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So it's... and then he said, no, try it. And I did. And then he said, Dave says, take care of it. And he wanted to give me the hornet. He'd already checked it out with Dave Monette.
Oh, wow.
Behind the spot before I even got there. So it's really sweet. And I was like, oh, my God. Like,
and he'd been planning this.
Yeah, he'd been planning to give it to me. And then it was confirmed when he heard me play it. And and he had switched back to trumpet. Now he switched back to cornet. So he's going back and forth. But he's got a different Monette cornet now.
He plays a really heavy instrument also.
His new one's pretty light, actually.
Oh.
In comparison.
The Ron.
Yeah.
Did you study with Ron?
It was never. I say yes, but it was never. It was never formal.
Uh-huh.
Was really interesting, but we would mostly hang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ron Miles, great trumpet player. So let me ask you this. Do you think that the sound that you currently get on that instrument was always in your head?
Yeah, I felt when I went back that, and it, I think it had something to do with playing cornet when I was 13, 14, 15, that I always had this more cornet sound in my head. And there was a gig, I played the Font Festival, and you asked me if my trumpet had a crook in it. I don't know if you remember that. No. When I was playing trumpet at the time.
How many years ago was that?
This was like 2006 or something like that.
Yeah.
And
many brain cells ago.
Could it have been at that theater in the East Village?
Yeah.
I was at that theater. Gig. Yeah. And you played, and also John O'Gallagher's band, Trio, played, right, with Masa Kamaguchi.
Yeah.
Ruben was in your band, Ruben Ratting, and Brian Dry, and Jeff
Davis. And Oscar Noriega played that night. Then the band after.
That really beautiful theater, I think it's on East 2nd or East 3rd.
What?
It was Clean Feet Festival.
And also used to collaborate with Clean Feed.
Yeah, it was a Clean Feed Festival.
Because he had so many great trumpet players on his label, so we would do some.
There was a Clean Feed night of the Font Festival.
Right, yeah.
That's what it was.
Because I knew it was Font Festival related. But,
right. And I asked you if it had a checkered's crook, your trumpet.
Yeah.
And it didn't.
It didn't.
But you had a sound that was cornet-like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but when I heard you playing last week, I don't know, there's something very particular about the sound that's different. That's probably what you always heard in your head, but I wonder if, you know, there's any particular work that you put in.
Well, there's a lot
to get it to sound that way.
The horn is difficult to play.
Yeah.
I've handed it to a lot of people that wanted to try it out, and just like when the first time I tried it out, most people can't even play above the staff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like
close.
Instantly hard to do. And then once you get past that, then I found that I can maneuver all around. But one of the things that I work on a lot is flexibility and really minute tuning stuff. So that and also like a lot of like reading books about vocal blending and things that people do with their throat and when they're singing, and I can get a lot of different kind of timbres out of it.
What I noticed was that you use intonation in a really interesting way. Like there's certain, at first I was listening and I was like, okay, it's certain notes that you might hit a little sharp or a little flat consistently, But I don't mean that in a, you know, in an unintentional way. Mm-hmm. And then I started to see it was more about certain fingerings you would hit a certain way.
Yeah.
And I started to realize, okay, this is like an intentional thing. You know, it's like a part of your sound is when you go by that A flat concert, mm-hmm. it's going to be slightly high. But high in a way like when you hear a great singer and they hit a note and it's a little high, it's for emotional effect.
Yeah.
So you've practiced, some thought into that.
I've practiced that a lot. Pushing a note up is much higher, if any brass note player would know.
Yeah.
It's much harder, than flattening it. But when you can, like, because I worked a lot with the pitch generator and tuner where, like, just pushing it up 5 cents, pushing it up 10 cents, pushing it up 15, and really watching the dial.
Wow.
And then getting it to become the next note, even on the last fingering, yeah. which is very hard going up.
Sure.
And I first learned about that because there was an Art Farmer exercise where he would slur down a third.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I worked on that a lot, and then also Steve Lacy talks about that in his book, doing it on the saxophone, you know, keeping one fingering and slurring down. But then I was thinking, well, could I slur all the way down? Could I slur an octave down mm-hmm. on the same finger?
Right.
What?
Play chromatically yeah. on one fingering, and then play up as well, and they start to sound really weird, but you can get all these real different timbres, and then right. it becomes more like singing.
That seems to me like a universe unto itself.
It's
really amazing. It would be like if you were playing the bass and you said to yourself, okay, I'm going to play this G, but I'm going to play it two strings away and bend the string mm-hmm. far enough to make the note happen. Mm-hmm. Of course, the note would sound different, but also like on the trumpet, you can hit any note with any fingering.
Wow.
And it takes a long time.
But it's really hard.
Wow. Because, I mean, for
but also, the higher you go in range, the easier it gets. Yeah, everything sort of converges at the high end of the horn.
Yeah, and that's where you can explain.
Because the harmonics are much closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the valves stop functioning, really, like they do at the bottom of the horn.
Okay. Yeah. Right. I mean, for a bass, like, it's what string you choose to play something, whether you use an open string, mm-hmm. certainly how you attack it with your pizzicato or mm-hmm. attack it with the bow, mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. But, you know, there's only so many G's.
And, right.
You know, I could pick a finger. I guess that's true. There's a world in there, too, for mm-hmm. sure. I mean, with anything.
Well, it's like if you say on the trumpet there's seven, you know, officially seven positions mm-hmm. with the three valves combinations.
Right.
Like if you're holding them all the way down and you don't have any weird tubes removed or anything like that, there's seven positions, and so you could play that G with any one of those seven positions, but each one would have a slightly different, timbral imprint.
Mm-hmm.
And also the intonation would be slightly different.
If you didn't
want
to change it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then one of those fingerings on the trumpet you only use one time, and it's in the natural, well, two times, I'm sorry, the natural fingering range with the low F sharp and the C sharp. That's the only two times you use all three. So then if you think about that, all the other notes are only with six. So there's like so few options. Really.
Certain type of sound, you know, even in the jazz community and certainly in the classical community.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm kind of sitting here at a table with two of, I think, the most unique sounding trumpet players.
All right.
Out there.
That was a high five. Out of fashion, but unique.
Is that something you set out?
It's
like a dumb question in a way.
Well, it's funny because we both know where you're going because we've encountered this question before. And Kirk is immediately saying, yes, I did. And my answer would be, no, I didn't. So kind of interesting.
Well, I thought about some basic elements and things I wanted to things I wanted to do that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think, and I'm not, I don't know what Dave was going to say, but I think that the more, if you practice and you make honest, you know, make honest appraisals of your playing and correct things that are wrong, you're going to have an original sound, and you don't have to make any conscious decisions as long as you like fill in the dots.
But you're also right. But you go ahead and finish your thought.
But what I was going to say was, I decided I like vibrato when it's not like this. I'm going to have a vibrato that's like this, and I'm going to work on that. I like how fat Lester Bowie's sound is. I want to have a really fat sound.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Not, I don't want to sound exactly like him, but I want that's something that I like, that I want.
But there's also like a your choice of harmonic language,
mm-hmm.
and also when I hear you play, it actually doesn't matter the tempo, but I was thinking specifically like fast lines. It's not this sort of like hyper articulated thing. It's much more of a smooth, beautiful like arc. And like, so the first time my wife came to see you play, I think you were playing with Jeff Davis's band. Mm-hmm. You know, we left and the first thing she said was like, "So what's the deal with the trumpet player?" and I said, "Oh, he's great, right?" And she's, "It's, he doesn't play like a trumpet player. He sounds, it's much smoother and much more."
I've actually gotten that sentence a lot. And one time Art Landy said it to me in kind of a mean way, which I actually interpreted later as a, like a really great compliment in some kind of thing. He's like, "You don't sound like a trumpet player. Is it, well, don't you even like Lee Morgan?" Like, I love Lee Morgan,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I never thought that any of those amazing guys like Lee Morgan sounded bad. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
But what I heard was different, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult question to ask.
Well,
and not
I worked a lot on articulation and smoothing it out. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing the John McNeil book exercises all the time.
Oh, wow.
You know,
okay.
with that slurring and tonguing articulation that trumpet players have classically used in jazz. And I worked on making that everything really even and making that tongue subtle sometimes and other times not.
Right.
And then I'll like to tongue every single note in an eighth note line sometimes for emphasis, like Steve Lacy would do.
Anymore, which we've talked about, and there's a lot more to talk about there. But I also noticed, you know, okay, you're talking about eighth note lines, and there's a language for using that in music, and any instrument does it, and there's a certain kind of lines that people tend to play, and everything, you know, sort of starts off based around that. Let's leave for now the sound aspect out of it, but just the mm-hmm. content of the notes.
Yeah.
So you like have these really unusual phrases and patterns that you're doing that very often to my ear don't come out of the standard jazz line of the way people's lines usually start out. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that, and I hope it's true. I take it as a compliment.
I mean it as a compliment, but also I was sitting there with a lot of trumpet players listening to you, and we're all like, okay, where's that coming from? What is that? What is that that he's playing? You know, where is that coming from? Did you write some ideas out for yourself?
One of the things I did was, I practiced a lot out of pattern books,
mm-hmm.
but not in order to ever play any of those patterns. Sure. It might sound ridiculous.
Well, no one wants to play the patterns.
Right. But for a while, for a couple years, because I've always taught myself, and then I've formed these like really strong opinions that I hold for a few years, and then usually abandon. But for a couple of years, I was like, screw the pattern books. I'm not ever going to end up playing like a David Baker lick on a gig. That would sound ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that what you can learn from those books is how to get around your instrument and all the different keys and that stuff that everybody wants to know. It's just like playing a scale. You're not going to go on the bandstand and play a scale like straight up and down. Well, at least I hope. Most people do that all the time with pentatonic scales, but we'll talk about that later. Just kidding. But you don't want to go and play a scale straight up and down, but you play these pattern books and then you learn how to get around. And then you learn how to make decisions about what to play and then what playing what you hear. And another thing that I got to do a bunch years ago was hang out with Ornette Coleman a bunch. And he told me a lot of little kernels of knowledge. And one of the things was he said was follow your idea to the end. And so one of the great things harmonically that you can do is if you have an idea and you don't decide to change it just because the song is telling you to change it, if you have a really solid idea, and it doesn't have to be not like a pattern idea, but like if you've got your sentence to say with a beginning and an ending and you just follow it through, and then you're going to be doing something interesting usually harmonically. So that's one thing. But then also just practicing nuts and bolts stuff all the time.
Sure.
You know, scales and arpeggios.
But yeah, and so what you do is very often scalar. Mm-hmm. I made up a new word again. So, it's just in very unusual numbers of notes and changes of direction. And,
Right?
But those, and that appears in your compositions as well, for sure.
There was another thing with Ornette where he stopped me. We were playing, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I said I'm doing," because it was one of the first times we played. And I said, "I'm doing what I thought you do." Yeah. And then we had a big long time. Whoa. We had a big long conversation about it. And he thought I was just doing it a lot faster.
Oh.
Like I said, "Well, I'm making up a chord progression as I go along, but sometimes I only do it for two notes or three notes or four notes." And then when you switch up the accents and everything, and then you're dealing with a whole another grid of things that you can constantly change. And the idea of changing direction is something I've thought about a lot, because it's kind of like you're either going up or you're going down, and you don't want to do it in the same way all the time. So there's a lot of like micro modulating happening. Mm-hmm.
And do you think about just something simple like playing? I'm going to play over the bar line, or is it something that happens just by virtue of finishing those sentences?
Yeah, I think more about finishing the idea than playing over it. But I did practice some exercises that you know, where you're approaching the chord before you get there and holding onto it after, like Hal Galper that I think was great to practice, because it gets you out of some of your habits.
So when you played with this trio with Mark Elias and Bill Goodwin, a lot of the conversation in the room was about how much they were inhabiting your tunes.
Oh, awesome.
Like how cohesive the band sounded coming out of your compositions. Somebody said it was during a bass solo. I don't know if you remember this. There was like spontaneous...
People were talking during the bass solo.
Well, yeah. No, they were talking the whole time. No. So they said something like, oh, this must be the bass player's tune. Because he was playing something that was like so much a part of the thing that you presented in making the composition. So... I just, you know, that this is the new record, right?
This record.
Can you talk about Mark and Bill, maybe?
It's coming out. Oh, I'd love to. I mean, it's. I don't know exactly when it's coming out yet, but it is done. So I've had this trio with Mark and Bill for a couple of years now, and it's a really special band because I love Mark Helias's playing since I was young, which I talked about on the
Me too.
That you gave
yeah.
him probably.
Me too. Me too.
But, so he was always somebody that I wanted to play with, and I hired him for a quartet that I had that happened a couple of times, and after that he hired me for some gigs, which was really an honor. And then I decided I wanted to have a trio with him, and at the same time I had started to play with Bill Goodwin, who's a fantastic drummer that people always associate with Phil Woods, because, and rightly so, because he's been playing in Phil Woods' band for the last 40 years.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah. So then I played, but the first time I heard Bill was on this bootleg with Art Pepper, because I'm a big Art Pepper fan, so I was like, who's this drummer? And I found out all about Bill, and then I contacted Bill and we started playing. And then I had the idea to put them to put these two guys together, because they've never played together before that group, and they admired each other, and Bill is so creative that I wanted him to be in a really free and open context, which he really appreciated, and he loves the band. And he was Tyshawn's teacher.
Right.
Oh, you know? Wow.
And if you tell Tyshawn about him, he's like, oh, man, you know, Bill is the greatest, and it's true. Bill is awesome.
Well, yeah, but if you talk to Bill about Mark Juliana and Tyshawn Sorey, he'll tell you that they're the ones that got him to start studying again.
And he said, it's also true, Matt Wilson, who I play with all the time, I say, you know, Bill loves your playing, and he says, "Well, I, you know, it's the same thing. I do all this stuff because of Bill." You know,
wow.
So that's those two guys. One funny story about Bill is he hired me to come up and play at the Deerhead to play tunes, which I love to do, but I never do because it's just I run around in these circles with people play original music.
Right.
So I was practicing to play. To go up to the Deerhead to play with Bill, and I was playing with some Ebersols, and then I realized that Bill was on the Ebersols, so I was actually playing with Bill to go play with Bill. I was like, wait a minute. This is because he did a bunch of those sessions.
Wow.
This is really kind of funny.
That's great.
That reminds me of the back in the old days. You know, Jim McNeely played on some of those too, and there's a particular Jamie Ebersol Music Minus One record that's based around rhythm changes. Mm-hmm. And so the violinist Mark Feldman had been practicing with this. This has got to be 25 years ago. And I was studying with Jim McNeely, and he came to hear us playing somewhere. And so Mark goes up to him and he said something like, I learned your tune, Flat Tire, Flat Tire. Just like on this. And Jim just like had no idea what he was talking about. Really great. That's moments awesome. In modern music. Yeah. So you played with Bill Goodwin before you went to play with Bill Goodwin.
Yes, exactly.
And then Helias just can occupy so much space in the best possible way within a trio situation.
Exactly.
I mean,
he
has such a special skill set. Mm-hmm. In terms of, well, just, I mean, the whole range of the bass, and, you know, it's unbelievable.
And to what Dave was just saying about them being inside the tunes, one of the things that is really conscious in that band is writing, that things are really pretty simple and open, because we also can't really rehearse because Bill lives in the Delaware Water Gap. Yeah. And
so, you don't need to rehearse with a guy like that.
And you don't need to either. He doesn't even want to see the music.
Right.
And not like he's doing anything wrong. He just, him reacting to it is what I want. And so I wanted those guys to be able to just to shine, and then also have things that were real vibes. So things aren't ambiguous because they're simple. It's like this tune is
I mean, this record has groovy, very clear bass lines and very clear melodies and grooves.
Yeah.
For sure.
And then on the record, there's guest spots by some great friends. Jeff Lederer, who I play with in Matt Wilson's band, plays soprano on one tune and tenor on one tune. And then Daniel Carter plays alto on one song, so on two songs, actually. So those are the guests, and then the rest of the record is trio, so it's like half trio and half guests.
I'm looking forward to that record.
And you're going to let us play some of it on the podcast, before it comes out?
Yes. So
ladies and
gentlemen,
come to
this podcast.
Is an exclusive. What about, so you have this other quartet with Billy Hart and Les Lossing.
On Steeplechase.
And Michael Fornack.
How about that?
That's another band with four people living in four different states. But that's really fantastic to play with them.
Do you, in the studio, do you take a fairly hands-on or hands-off approach to directing traffic when it's more of an open?
With that band especially, it was really hands-off, because when they started playing, the three of them, I was just had this feeling like, man, all I have to do is not mess this up and it's going to be a great record. Because Billy Hart, forget about it, and Michael Formanek.
Yeah, he sounds so great on that. It's amazing.
He was really...
so identifiable. Really, you allowed him to have his own sound.
And Nils Winther, the producer of that record, called me the next day and he said, you know, Billy really had fun on that session, I could tell. And he said, and he really opened up and sounded great, you know. So there was only one tune we did more than two takes of on that record too, and that's only because we changed. Russ and I had different ideas, not conflicting ones, but like, well, let's try this, well, let's try this on the tune called School. So we ended up doing that's one's more complicated, but we just changed the arrangement a few times. The only reason we recorded it more than a couple times. Everything else is either a first take or a second take.
Beautiful.
It's always funny when you record an album and then you have a tune where you try it a few different ways, and then when you have to go back a month or two later to listen and make a decision, it's like, wait a minute, they're both valid and they're just a different vision of how the tune could be. And I sort of feel like that gets overlooked in the listening to the music, in the perception of the music sometimes, how malleable things really are. And even like the classic Blue Note era jazz records that we look to as the Holy Grail, if you talk to a lot of the musicians who were there, they'll tell you, well, that was just one way of doing that tune that day.
Yeah.
And now it's like, that's the way it is standard in the canon, and this is the way that you have to play it. And it's sort of like, it's really an eye-opener, you know, that we're free to present our music the way we want to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it's always been done.
Yeah, that's true.
So, really, I hope you get a chance to release, like, as an extra take, the other version of that tune.
Cool.
Because it's good for, I think it's great. You know, the improvisation is such a quintessential part of the development of the pieces, that to be able to expose that side of things is really important.
Composers that you admire.
One interesting thing, just as an overview thing, I often really like the music that drummers write, and it is similar, I feel like, to the way I write, but it was never an intentional thing. It just ends up happening when I get music from drummers. I get to play with a lot of great ones, thankfully. Matt Wilson's band I play in, and Allison Miller's band I play in, and then I get to play with Bill. But they, you know, there's these tunes that are more about, like, drummers seem to write music that's more about, like, an environment than necessarily, like, any, mm-hmm. like, a compositional, like, objective of, right, like, right. You know, it's this yeah. this kind of universe. And then
Rudy Royston's tunes, you know, his,
yeah.
You're right, that's very perceptive.
And then historically, I really liked, obviously, Steve Lacy's music, which I've studied a lot, and then and Ornette Coleman's music.
Roswell Rudd, I'm sure.
Roswell, yeah.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I've gotten to play with Roswell. He's such an amazing guy.
Yeah.
But my favorite compositions and the ones that I like, and Carla Bley, I should really mention because she's a big one.
That's right.
It's really like a launch pad. Even with some of Carla Bley's longer music, longer forms, it's still like that. Last night I played duo gig with Jesse Stack and the pianist, and we played Jesus Maria and a lot of Carla Bley tunes, and also some of the really open ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea that anything can be a tune. It can be just the littlest idea, and then if you have the right people, and if you, you know, you can really get it started. It doesn't have to be too much stuff, but it can be too if you really want it to be like Jesus Maria. There's a ton of information.
Yeah,
it's a long song.
For sure,
it's beautiful. Yeah. So I don't advocate only for short and simple music. Sometimes for me it'll really just be what the first idea was will be the tune, and then the where the tune goes is the final
document.
Yeah, that's the composition too. So it's, instead of like having this idea and then transposing it up to make the tune longer, I just have the first idea, and then we're gonna go there, and it's gonna be different every time, like Dave was just saying. We can really make it a different thing every time.
Yeah, and where does the tune end, and where does the improvisation begin?
Yeah.
You want to blur those lines, for sure.
I think that's something all three of us would work towards.
You know, we started out talking about Louis Armstrong, maybe in a different context, but we
I love
some
Louis
kind
Armstrong.
Of a link there too. Would you say?
Well, it took
musically. No, I'm not talking about the laxative.
No, Swiss Chris comments here. No, musically, I got really into Louis Armstrong later because when I was younger, the first people that really gripped me were guys like Freddie Hubbard, which that's incredibly exciting still for me.
Yeah,
stuff like that. Yeah. And then it took me a while to go back in time. But then when I got to like all the hot fives and sevens, and then I haven't gotten the very newest one, but I've read as many books as I can find on Louis Armstrong, and he just had such an unstoppable rhythmic propulsion. Mm-hmm. Just when he played quarter notes, that it's just like all he does is go da da. And you're like, yes, this is the greatest thing that ever happened, is like these four That's quarter right. notes in a row. And it's That's just right. like, yeah. I just think he was so brilliant with that. So I think about that all the time. And talking about people that played trumpet and cornet, Louis Armstrong started out on cornet, but I believe absolutely that he was a trumpet player, because the final result when he was playing trumpet is like, absolutely he had to be playing the trumpet for that
to sound. Do that. To drive the whole band. With and those that, four quarters.
And that just crystal thing that he had, you know, that clarion thing, that's definitely a trumpet sound, I think.
Great.
Yeah. He's one of my main men. I make a yearly pilgrimage to the Louis Armstrong house, 4 years anyway in a row.
That's enough for it to be annual.
It's awesome.
Because it's an amazing
It's in
place.
Queens, right? Yeah, what it's neighborhood? It's in
Corona.
Corona, Queens. Yeah, if you haven't been...
It's
podcast listeners, check it out. You know what's funny is I did a bunch of gigs with Enrico Rava, and he plays the Louis Armstrong solo from West End Blues in his warm-up in the dressing room
before
every show.
Wow, that's awesome.
I'm like, okay, I hear it down the hall. I'm like, okay, he's ready.
Wow. Because that was such a triumph of technique at the time, and it still is. Nobody did that kind of stuff when that came out.
Well, Kurt Konofsky, so great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's been fun. It's always fun to play.
Yes.
Thanks for the music. Keep it coming.
Absolutely.
We'll be listening.
All right.
Stopping by the podcast, and that's a lot of great brass music, and in the coming episodes we'll probably veer away from so much brass music.
Yes, more bass.
But we're doing more episodes, and we're glad that you're following however you are. If you're getting this at iTunes, or if you're getting it directly from the Greenleaf Music website, there's a few other outlets, but it really does help if you leave us a review at iTunes. And you can also email us.
It's podcast@greenleafmusic.com.
podcast@greenleafmusic.com. What Michael said.
Like that's I said.
How you would send us an email. And, you know, we're really going into the end of this coming year. I've been thinking about, you know, how are we going to get to episode 100? And, people are listening. Like we said a few episodes ago, we appeared in a poll, and
near
that was
the top.
Shocked. We were the Jazz Times podcast poll. The only podcast that beat us was the Jazz Times podcast. Surprise, surprise. So anyway, yeah, and no sour grapes, but it was kind of amazing to us that people are listening, and we do this because we enjoy it and because we love the music, and we hope that you love it too. So come and just say hello and send a suggestion if you want to. We've had a lot of actually really good and interesting suggestions. We're working on getting those people on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.